Hi, ActiveHistory.ca is pleased to present a recording of Julie Gilmore's talk, Trouble on Main Street, William Lyon Mackenzie King, Reason, Race, and the 1907 Vancouver Riots. This talk was delivered as part of the Ottawa Historical Association Lecture Series on March 10, 2015. You can find recordings of other talks at ActiveHistory.ca.
My instinct is to turn this direction, so apologies. I'm really excited to be here in Ottawa. I have really good feelings about this place. I've spent lots of time in the archives here, and I have lots of friends here, and so I'm really grateful for the invitation to come and talk to you about my work and include you in what's become a sort of year-long celebration of the completion of this book. It is available on Amazon and everywhere else. So if you like what you hear tonight, please do go out and buy it. Then maybe I can write another one. Okay? So I have the impression that maybe what might be of most interest to you here tonight isn't a whole lot of content about what's in the book, but maybe a little discussion about why this book, why in this way, and the sources I use to write it. And part of my motivation in talking about that is I want to kind of be an advocate for two different sources that maybe don't get considered very much by Canadian researchers on King and on international relations and history in general. And so I want to be a bit of an advertisement for those sources or sort of publicize those. And those two sources are the wonderful, rich Canadian materials at Kew in London, especially if you're writing about Canada before 1914. One of the best places to read about Canada is in London, in the UK. And they have a fantastic archive there that's very searchable online. It's a very civilized archive to use. And because Canada was kind of a special case, often the Canadian materials are all collected together. So if you can figure out which of the files you're interested in, it's a very, very efficient way to read the correspondence, for example, between the Prime Minister and the Governor General, or between the Governor General and Foreign Office or the Colonial Office, this sort of thing. So part of what I want to do today is really encourage Canadian researchers to take advantage of this incredible collection. The other thing I'd like to encourage us to get back in sort of circulation is these private international relations diaries that Mackenzie King wrote and that aren't available online yet. Despite Library and Archives Canada's promise that all of King's diary is searchable online, these are not. And currently you need to read microfiche or the actual diary in the archive to have access to it. And it's this fantastic, rich, complicated, extraordinary source that I found just so amazing to work with. And so I'm going to give you some examples of the wonderful stuff you can find in there and some of the kinds of questions you can investigate. I guess my third motivation about this talk is to kind of also agitate for thinking about King before he was Prime Minister. We think of him as this old, round, eccentric, spiritualist, dog-loving, mother-loving, awkward creature. No matter where you stand on his politics, these are the things that people reflect back to you when you say, oh, I write about Mackenzie King, and then you get the story about whatever, right? So, but your experience of William Lyon Mackenzie King is really, really different when you read his materials from when he was a young man. He was a man of promise, of potential. He was in demand. He was desired as a dance partner. He was desired as a conversationalist at a dinner table. He was the protege of powerful men, mostly liberals. The Governor General, Albert Gray, his cousin, Edward Gray, in the Foreign Office in London. Sir Wilfrid Laurier, and Lord Morley in the India Office. All of them, and Roosevelt to a certain extent as well, all of them wanted to take him under their wing and send him on his way to become... They all wanted to use him, too, don't get me wrong. They all had their purposes. But they also wanted to encourage this man of promise, this young man who had all the right stuff, right? He'd gone to Harvard, right? He'd had the blessing of the outside. He'd gone to the LSE. He'd lived in Britain. He'd lived in the U.S. He'd lived in Canada. He had a legal education. He had it all sort of going. Oh, and he had pedigree, right? His grandfather was, like, a political celebrity in Canada. So that's the third thing. So these are the three things, right? The Q collection, Canada, the private international relations diary, and Mackenzie King as a young man. As Jennifer mentioned in my introduction, I started thinking about Mackenzie King because he dragged his feet like crazy in 1947 and earlier on the question of opening Canada's doors to refugees after World War II. He made a big stink. He made it really hard for foreign affairs. He made it really hard for everyone who wanted to bring people in Europe to Canada. And I was really struck by his fear of inadmissibility. It's a horrible word to say. I don't have a better one, though, so I'm stuck with it. He was really concerned that Canadians had a really hard time with immigrants that they felt couldn't become Canadians in a timely manner. And what was he thinking when he was saying this? Well, he was remembering the violence, property damage that resulted in the 1907 Vancouver riots. In 1907, Canadians were anxious on the West Coast about the numbers of Chinese, Japanese, and Indian immigrants that were entering the country. It turns out that Japan had an agreement with Canada to sort of control the number of people arriving, but nevertheless, there were a lot of people coming from Hawaii, which Japan had no control over, by the way. And yet, so there are these Japanese faces, from the Canadian perspective, arriving in Vancouver. And this caused fear amongst a certain population. They weren't just Canadian fears. There were Asian exclusion groups all up and down the Pacific Coast, Seattle, San Francisco, Vancouver. And so this was kind of a Pacific phenomenon. There were a number of riots in 1907, and Vancouver is one of them. In September, there was a group who collected at City Hall to protest Asian migration to Canada. A huge number of people gathered. And they marched up the street, and they heard this speech by an American exclusion activist by the name of Fowler. And one thing led to another, and bricks were thrown, and windows were broken, and there was a lot of property damage. And days or weeks later, depending on who you talk to, things kind of calmed down. Well, this caused an enormous international relations dilemma for Britain, and thus for Canada. Why? Well, Canada had a trade agreement with Japan that promised free movement and the protection of property under Canadian law for Japanese subjects. And so when all of this property damage occurred, this law, which Canada signed on to, by the way, in 1906, came into effect, and Canada was responsible for finding a way to provide restitution to the Japanese. And a royal commission was quickly established. And Mackenzie King, being a loyal functionary in the Department of Labor and a sort of protege of Laurier's, becomes the commissioner for the investigation into damages of Japanese property. Well, Mackenzie King's a renowned mediator by this time. He has yet to be elected to Parliament. He's a civil servant. He's a lawyer. He has worked in a lot of labor disputes. And he's not a stupid man. And he realizes that the Chinese needed to be included in this as well. And so he's the one who agitates for a commission to study the Chinese damages in these same events. And while he's there, he also learns something else. He learns through the Chinese community that Canada has been tacitly allowing the production of opium in Vancouver in at least six different factories, some of which have claimed damages due to the riot. And he's just so angered by Canada's complicity in this moral failing. Mackenzie King is a social gospel, prohibition kind of social uplift liberal. And he is just baffled that Canada will allow itself to take a poor moral position. And so he says, enough. We're not enforcing the provincial narcotics laws here. We need to do better, and we need a federal narcotics control law. So in July 1908, he's the one who drafts the very first narcotics control bill. It's introduced July 10th, if you want to look it up. I can send you the details. It passes in record time. His boss, Rodolphe Lemieux, doesn't even have time to introduce the bill in Parliament before the Prime Minister... Wait, is it yet the Prime Minister? No. Before the Leader of the Opposition, Sir Robert Borden, says, no, you don't even need to finish. We all know this has to pass. And so it goes unanimously to a second reading, it goes unanimously to a third reading, and within days, it's passed and Canada has its first narcotics control bill. And what happens? Mackenzie King becomes our expert on opium. Mackenzie King is now our expert on Chinese immigration, Japanese immigration, Indian immigration, opium, and all the usual trade stuff that he was involved in. Well, this becomes an extraordinary opportunity in the career of young Mackenzie King. He's about to be elected to Parliament. He's elected in 1908, in the fall. And around the same time, he starts gaining this international reputation. The Americans quickly figure out that he's Canada's expert on opium. And their expert on opium, Bishop Charles Brent, also a Canadian, also a graduate of the University of Toronto, who happens to be the Episcopal Bishop of the Philippines, says, you need to get Mackenzie King invited to this commission we're going to have in Shanghai in 1908. We are all going to get together, this international community, and we are going to organize the control of opium globally. We're going to solve this problem. So what this is a reflection of this moment at the turn of the last century when international commissions and conventions start to really take off. They're not very good at it yet, but they're getting there. And Brent encourages Roosevelt, and or the State Department, really, to have Mackenzie King invited as a member of the British Commission, the British delegation to Shanghai. So here we have this wonderful, extraordinary reflection of Canada in 1908, right? We have a Canadian-born American Episcopal bishop encouraging the President of the United States to have the Governor General of Canada communicate with the Foreign Office of Britain to invite this Deputy Minister of Labor to come to Shanghai to represent Canada, to represent Britain, to represent this middle position between between the United States and Great Britain, because they know that Britain's very pragmatic economic position on opium and the United States' enthusiastic moral social uplift prohibition position on opium are going to be at odds. And Mackenzie King is going to be this middle ground. So he becomes this wonderful lens to look at Canada's relationship with Britain, Britain's relationship with the United States, Canada's relationship with the United States, and this shift that's going on at the turn of the last century between Britain and the United States as Canada shifts its focus. It's also an extraordinary moment because we see that despite a kind of shared racism, all of these men share the same worries about Asian immigration. Okay, they all feel that unassimilable Asian immigrants, from their perspective, are something that should be controlled. Why are they afraid of this? We can see from King's diary that he's shocked when he meets Chinese people in China, because they're not like the Chinese people he met on the railway. He expected all Chinese people to be like the manual laborers that he encounters working on the sea. And he meets Chinese gentlemen, men who had studied at Yale and spoke English, people he got along very well with. And he had no trouble dealing with them, but it was a surprise to him. And so he's still trying to control Chinese immigration, but he has these interesting relationships with gentlemen from all over the world. The same is true of India. He makes the most remarkably racist statements in his diary about his travels through India. He hates Indian architecture. He hates Indian sculpture. He likes Buddhist sculpture, by the way. He likes the Zen aesthetic. He finds Indian culture upsetting. And yet, he has very interesting conversations with Indian nationalists while he's in India. And despite really agreeing with them on many things, all of his support is contingent on the idea that they support reducing Indian immigration to Canada. So there's this really interesting phenomenon where class becomes a much more significant fracture point than race when you're dealing amongst the gentlemen. My husband likes to call this the League of International Gentlemen. Mm-hmm. Right? They have certain things in common. They have a kind of faith in government and experts to improve the lives of their citizens. They have a certain faith in education to raise people up. Many of them are multilingual. Many of them have a certain amount of money. All of them are interested in some of the same questions, despite the sort of cultural background that they come with. And King has no trouble managing his relationships with these people. So despite the racism that remains in the immigration policy, there's this other relationship in international dealings at the Shanghai Opium Commission. While King is in China after the commission ends, his private diary also gives us a glimpse into his efforts to end the head tax. Can you imagine an end to the Chinese head tax in 1908 instead of in the 20s? Okay? So what happened was he went to the acting head of the Chinese Foreign Office, who was in the midst of a very chaotic time in Chinese government, right? The emperor had died, the dowager empress had died, there was a lot of intrigue going on, and he was put in place in the Foreign Office. So he had bigger things to worry about than this Canadian. But his diary assuming that we can corroborate some of his claims in his diary, which is another question altogether. His diary provides us at least with his interpretation of the conversations he had in China and how he achieved them. What do we learn? We learn that Canada only gets as far as it does because of the British support. The British embassy in Beijing, Peking at the time, Sir John Jordan was the ambassador. He gets Mackenzie King in to see the Foreign Office. Canada has no standing at court, but the British are respected, and so Canada gets in. Canada thinks it has no treaty relationship with China at the time. It turns out they're wrong. It's just that the treaty was signed in the 1840s before Canada existed. Another little insight into like what Canadian foreign policy in 1908 might be like. if you're dealing with treaties that existed, that you're responsible for even before you existed. The third thing was that Sir John Jordan made sure that Mackenzie King was very, very well prepared for his meetings. He let him know ahead of time what some of the areas of contention might be, some of the areas he might consider finding solutions for. And the result is that Mackenzie King comes this close to negotiating an end to the head tax in 1908, but it fails because it fails to go further in the Chinese government because other priorities come up. But he gets an agreement in principle to voluntary restriction in the number of exit visas from China, the same kind of gentleman's agreement that Canada already has with Japan, that Rodolphe Lemieux negotiated at the end of 1907 with Japan. So that's kind of an interesting little footnote in history that we might otherwise not have access to if we don't read Mackenzie King's really interesting diaries, plus corroborating things with these fantastic documents from Kew. All of these materials were collected very carefully by the Foreign Office under the Japan desk. The Japan desk has a file this thick on the Vancouver riots. They have an accompanying file about that thick on the Shanghai Opium Commission, following Mackenzie King, following his work, following his notes, collecting them all, collecting Sir John Jordan's comments, collecting other British commissioners' comments, collecting the materials, the discussion materials from the Opium Commission and the final decisions. All right there for you at Kew in this sort of wonderful research space. So let me wrap this all up by saying that these wonderful, rich sources make for a wonderful book that is very readable. I thought I should talk a little today about the fact that I wrote this book for a trade press and not for an academic press, because it really did change the way I wrote it, but not the way I researched it. So if there's any interest, I thought I'd talk a little bit about that, because we get very caught up in the formula of writing for an academic audience, and we lose track of the narrative sometimes, I think. And this is the thing that is such a powerful motivator for average is the wrong word, for a reader, right? This is what takes you from page to page and chapter to chapter, is that flow of a narrative. And Mackenzie King's diary is so awesome for providing you with some of those little details that make these kind of stories really come alive. He provides menu items. If you'd like to know what Roosevelt ate at lunch, it's right there for you, right? It provides insight into the architecture that he's seeing and how much he hates Hindu architecture because it's so sexual. Right? His little Presbyterian soul can't deal with all of these breasts, right? And these aren't always the kinds of materials that are in government publications, right? So it's really a pleasure and amusing and worthwhile and historically useful to have access to them. And so I would encourage everyone to think about writing strong narrative, even in your professional writing, even in your reports. Not that boobs need to be in everything, but you know. So I hope that maybe I've encouraged you to think about London as a source, Mackenzie King's private diaries as a source, and writing strong narrative even when not required to. And those are, I guess that's where I'll finish, and I'm happy to answer all of your questions. So.
You've been listening to a recording of Julie Gilmore's talk, Trouble on Main Street, William Lyon Mackenzie King, Reason, Race, and the 1907 Vancouver Riots. The talk was delivered as part of the Ottawa Historical Association Lecture Series on March 10, 2015. You can find recordings of other talks at activehistory.ca.